time. And ever since you entered my life, I don't feel alone anymore. So go on and YouTube, Twitter, Facebook me. That's the way to get closer, you see. We used to be strangers, but now that won't be. If you subscribe, then get back to me.
Well, that was the social media song from Shimona. It's just here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, a weekly Blog Talk radio show where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we're making up a show that was somehow did not work on Friday here on Monday, thanks to the Vito Esposito show with Big Al that has given us the spot for a replacement show. And we want to talk about social media with Mount St. Mary's University philosophy professor Joshua Hochschild, who's the author of the 2017 book, A Mind at Peace, Reclaiming an Ordered Soul in the Age of Distraction, by Sophia Institute Press. Well, Joshua, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you for having me on the show. Is this connection good enough for you?
Yeah, this is excellent. Okay, well, the jinx that we had last Friday is off, and we're coming here together on Monday for Conservative Casual Friday, and hopefully this will lighten up some people at the beginning of the week here. Well, this is an interesting book you co-authored here on social media, and it has an opening, a foreword by Father Paul Scalia, where he talks about the insertion of digital technology into every sphere of life disconnects us from not only all sorts of things, but our very souls, and that therefore to think, see, reason, and touch have taken on all new meaning. Well, discuss Father Scalia's statement here. Why is this digital technology, this social media, not just a new convenience?
Well, I mean, I think part of what we've noticed is that the success of social media is that it taps into something very, very deep in our nature. It taps into our desire for connection. It taps into our desire for knowledge. It taps into our desire for attention and status. And, you know, these are all things that are part of being human. They can very easily lead us astray, but they're not evil in and of themselves. And in a healthy environment, they can be part of what lead us back to God. But, you know, the social media environment even beyond social media, just the having of a computer in your pocket and a screen that can display anything at the touch of a button means that we are experimenting with a kind of power that is beyond, you know, anything that human beings have experimented with before, and it's a real test of our virtue. It's a test of our ability to engage in exercises of moderation, of courage, of the right ordering of our desires.
Well, now, in this foreword, Father Scalia talks about how God himself in the Christian understanding comes down in human form to people, and thus the language of salvation is that of human senses. I mean, Jesus interacts on a human level, physical level. In your discussion, you just right there, you're talking about we need to sort of watch our power. That seems to be a contrast that God came down to us as humans, but is this modern technology, this social media, making people feel godlike?
I mean, that's a good question. I think I would want to refine it a little bit and point out that there's a way in which social media is very natural and appeals to our incarnate selves, who are embodied and who bond to things physically. I mean, the design of a modern smartphone is really ingenious, the way it appeals to our eyes, but also it's something that we hold and something that we carry and something that we touch. And that it seems to give us a kind of transcendent power at the same time that it's a physical object. It seems to give us access to something that transcends our immediate environment. It puts us in touch with something that is beyond our immediate presence. So there's something very incarnational about modern technology. But that's precisely why we're drawn to it, but it's precisely the danger of it, because, of course, if we seek the transcendent, or if we seek a kind of embodiment of that which is divine without an actual true orientation to the Trinitarian God and to the person of Jesus Christ, then we can very, very easily and quickly go astray.
Well, how do you think then, I mean, Father Scalia goes into issues here about, you know, God is represented in the Bible as the savior of my faith, that to be human, it means you have a faith and are capable of relationships and therefore beholding God, and sin takes that away. And that these social media tools, if they get in our way of what it means to be human, then we need God to restore us to ourselves. How do you think, in what you're discussing here, how do you think social media technology has affected people's understanding of faith?
Boy, that's a very, very big question. I was very gratified, Father Scalia, for writing the foreword to our book. The co-author and I wrote it with a good friend of mine, Christopher Bloom, and he really had the original vision for the book, and I was very, very honored that he asked me to be a part of the project and to cooperate with him in writing it. Chris and I both have a background in philosophy. That's our academic training, and we both teach philosophy. But we're also both converts to Christianity, to Catholicism, and we wanted to do something. It's not an academic book. It's a real accessible, practical guide. It's the kind of thing that can be used in a book group or for a kind of retreat study. We wanted to write something that would help to lead people back to Christian sources of spiritual wisdom, but did so by acknowledging the kinds of philosophical challenges that social media presents. So the short argument of the book is that not that social media and modern technology are themselves evil, but that they present certain kinds of challenges to human beings to use them well, and that to answer those challenges, we need both a kind of renewal of the natural virtues, and we need to ask for supernatural grace to enter into our use of social media. So in that sense, it's not really a new solution. It's finding hope in the fact that the Catholic intellectual tradition has resources, both philosophical and spiritual, to address new challenges, as long as we are very, very attentive to the new environment in which those resources need to be applied. I hope that makes sense.
I find that very interesting. You're talking about social media and internet technology, I mean, here in the 21st century. But the book, of course, consistently recurs and bases itself upon, you know, teachings of, you know, Christian teaching, classical teaching from the ancients, Aristotle, St. Augustine, Aquinas. That's an interesting combination. So you really think then that I guess it's an interesting contrast that, you know, we really have to go sort of back into the future, as it were, that we have to return to the ancient world to understand what we're doing in the modern world.
Well, I mean, one of the things we believe as Christians is that there's nothing new under the sun. That doesn't mean that, you know, time stands still or that there aren't new circumstances, but the deepest truths about how we should live our lives are not going to be new truths, but we might need to find fresh ways to see the relevance of ancient truths. I mean, I'll take one example. There is very, very ancient spiritual reflection on the sin of sloth. And the Latinate term for that is usually acedia. And the sin of sloth is often related to another sin of curiositas. I'm using the Latin term because curiosity in English is often thought of as a good thing, right? We want children to be curious and seek learning. But curiositas is a disordered desire for knowledge. It's associated with things like gossip and procrastination and wasting time. Augustine accuses himself of curiositas when he spends too much time going to the theater or watching the gladiator combat. So those categories for spiritual challenges originally arose in the context of a very different environment when the failure of the will to act or the disorder of the attention, had a particular kind of environment, a small city, a gladiator combat, a play, but they apply to what it is that smartphones tempt us to do. They tempt us to be spectators instead of acting, right? As any parent knows who's been tempted to, pay attention to the smartphone instead of look their children in the eye when their children are talking to them. Or they distract us and make us think that we're learning when we're not, when we're really just indulging a kind of desire for more information, but not a general reflection and contemplation on the truths that matter. So if we could remind ourselves of some of the old spiritual categories and apply them to the new challenge of digital technology, I think we're halfway there towards getting a handle on what the technology is doing to us. It's not enough just to name the sins, obviously. We then have to reflect on how we're guilty of them and think about what things we'll do in order to practice purging ourselves of those sins. But a big part of learning how to deal with this new technology will be realizing that the spiritual resources that we need have been extensively thought about and articulated and taught by ancient classical thinkers.
Yeah, and that comes up pretty really clear in this book. It's a thorough grounding in these sources dealing with this modern technology. Well, you talk in the book that people today are less settled and more easily manipulated, more distracted, more worried than 30 years ago, and how fear is a terrible passion. It repels people, and without tremendous force of character, we simply run from fears. How does social media increase fear?
It does it in a number of ways, but I think that what gets talked about most of the time in sort of mainstream media is how social media can try to appeal to our passions in particular ways in order to increase engagement. I mean, social media works by drawing clicks, drawing eyeballs, and any marketer will tell you that people are motivated more easily by other emotions. And so there are ways in which, intentionally or not, the things that get the most attention in digital media are going to be ones that appeal to our sense of fear. But, our book actually doesn't go into a lot of detail about that. What Chris and I bond to is the fact that even people who maybe aren't drawn towards strong ideological websites or conspiracy theories or anything that would arouse the passions, what they notice is that the prevalence of this technology in daily life has just sort of unsettled them, that it's just made them made it hard to concentrate. It's made it hard to feel like one can follow through. It's made it hard to sit and have an extended conversation with people. It's made it hard for people to read deeply and reflectively. And, you know, it strikes me that one of the most common words to describe the effect of modern digital technology is that it's distracting, that it's constantly sort of interrupting us. It's constantly making us aware that there's more, there's an opportunity for more, there's another notification. The default settings on all of these devices, laptops and phones, is that, you know, there can be multiple things open at once, that you can always have notifications pushed to you. And so the idea that one can just sort of be alone with one's thoughts and have some time to step outside of the very present moment. I think a lot of what people are feeling, a sense of dis-ease, a lack of peace, and that's why we decided to call the book A Mind at Peace. The subtitle is Reclaiming an Ordered Soul in the Age of Distraction. What it is that people are seeking, you know, Aristotle called it happiness in the Ethics, and John Paul II describes it as freedom in Veritatis Splendor. But another way to describe that inner psychological order that people are always seeking, whether they would name it this or not, is as a kind of peace. And peace isn't just an absence of conflict. Peace isn't when you eliminate all violence. Peace is a certain kind of ordered activity where things are working as they should and coordinated. And the human being is a very, very sophisticated organism that was meant to live a certain kind of social life and was meant to know and love God. And modern digital media appeals to some of the powers that enable us to do those things, but often misdirects them or leads them astray, so that we actually feel less connected to others. We feel less capable of friendship. We feel less capable of prayer. And Chris and I wanted to write a book that would help people reclaim their sense of agency over their attention, over their desires, over their ability to communicate and to think and to share time with people, so that the social media and digital technology could be returned to the status of a useful tool and not a whole environment that we seem to be subject to.
Well, I guess that's an interesting perspective that, you know, I guess many people would praise social media and modern internet technology precisely because there's a sense of we have so much freedom now with this social media. I mean, is that how do you balance that? That, you know, many people say we have lots of freedom, but you're saying, no, actually, we're just getting really distracted.
Well, I think it would be really interesting to ask people if they do feel that they have been made free by social media. The most common kind of impression that I get is that people wouldn't give up their smartphones, but they feel a little guilty about that, and they suspect that their dependence on them is almost a kind of addiction. It's actually become a kind of luxury for those who have the leisure and the money to afford it, to structure life so that one can live without smartphones sometimes. So very elite schools make sure that children don't have access to phones during the day. Very elite, well-to-do families who pay for things like nannies to take care of their children will pay more for a nanny who doesn't have a smartphone and who can enforce their children being off of screen time. We now know even that the people who designed things like the iPad and the smartphone and different social media apps don't allow their own children to have those things. They were designed and engineered to attract us, but not because they would make us better. They were designed to attract us because they would make us dependent on somebody who could monetize our attention. And, you know, there's been some very interesting social science research about this. Sherry Turkle has written a number of books, sociologists at MIT, I believe, and she's written some very interesting books interviewing young people, teenagers, parents, about their attitudes towards digital technology in their lives. And most of them feel very resentful about it. Most young people feel like they have a harder time connecting with their peers. Most feel that it's made it harder for them to connect with their own parents. I know from my own life that my children, you know, love it if they know that there's going to be a period of time of day when nobody's going to be on screens, if we're going to go for a walk in the woods, or if we're going to decide to play a game together as a family. That has become, a special moment that we have to be very intentional about. Whereas once upon a time, without even trying, kids would get to spend time with family members. Now we have to intentionally set aside time to make sure that we're giving attention to other people instead of to screens. And young people notice that. I think that in a way we've subjected young people to a very, very dangerous cultural experiment. You and I, grew up without this technology, and so we've tried our best, presumably, to integrate it into a mode of life that had already developed without it. But my college freshmen today, most of them had a smartphone, like an iPhone, when they were in middle school or earlier. They don't remember life without it, and they don't remember their parents without these things. So their experience of the world is very different. And in my experience, they're actually very eager for a chance to learn what life could be like if it weren't dominated by this technology.
Well, that brings up interesting points. Well, what age do you think I guess it raises like a practical question. What age do you think it is good for a child to have a smartphone?
Well, I definitely don't think that anyone before high school should have a smartphone. And actually, I think if you lived in a community where parents could collaborate together, either the parents, the families themselves, or the families through the medium of a school or a parish, and set very strict rules, it would be ideal if high schoolers didn't have smartphones. Now, I'm something of a hypocrite on that count, because as my kids have entered high school, we've allowed them to have smartphones. But part of that is because I have feared that the alternative would be to condemn them to a certain kind of social isolation. They've gone to a conventional school, and most of the students there have phones, and so to be able to socialize at all today seems to require smartphones. But I do know that there are communities, there are schools, there are groups of homeschoolers who realize that if they're very intentional about it, they can set a stricter standard, and that you don't have to make a student feel like they're isolated, that they're left out. If they're part of a community where there are common standards. But I think one of the important things that this shows, the book that we wrote is certainly very much focused on the ways in which the individual can take some responsibility for cultivating virtues of healthy technology use. But it's very important to remember that we are social beings and we live in communities, and there are certain kinds of virtues that are very hard to practice alone. If everyone else around you is intemperate in a certain respect, and if for you to be a part of a community involves somehow signaling certain ways that you participate in its activities, it can be very, very difficult to exercise temperance with respect to, say, staying off of social media. If all of your friends are on social media and you aren't, it's almost like you have a choice between remaining friends with them or not. That can be a very tough choice for a young person to make. It's certainly a tough choice for an older adult to make. This is one of the reasons why I'm glad to be on your show, Andrew, because I think that thinking about these issues is something that we shouldn't just do alone, but we need to do in communities, and we need to think about how those in our sphere of influence, in our family, in our neighborhoods, in our schools, in our parishes, can work together to be intentional about exercising moderation in our dependence on digital technology.
Well, talking about youth today, I guess, you know, as you mentioned, you know, people of our age, you know, we didn't grow up this way. How do youth respond? You say that if youth don't have a smartphone, they feel like they're left out. How is that so? Like, how is the life of youth today become so dominated by social media?
Well, and it's not necessarily social media in terms of one of the apps where people are posting things, but just the ability to communicate with friends about, hey, where are you going to be? Where can we connect this weekend? Hey, have you heard this news? You know, when I was growing up, we, you know, friends called each other on the phone or they arranged to meet somewhere and hang out for a while. That was sometimes difficult and awkward, but it was a way that young people could share time and space and learn from each other. If everybody else in your friend circle is using Snapchat to share ideas and pass on inside jokes or to coordinate where they're going to go and what they're going to do, and you don't have access to that app, it becomes very difficult for a young person to remain part of that friend group. And I actually think there are a lot of young people who don't want to use social media, who don't like Snapchat or who don't like whatever it is that their friends are using, but they submit to using it because it's the way to keep in touch with their friends. And if there were social structures in place that encouraged them to try something else or that told them that they didn't have access to this technology at all or during certain periods of the day or certain periods of the week, that they would find some other way to get in touch with their friends. But, I mean, kids, this is the thing about children is that they're very adaptive, they're very creative, and they will use whatever environment they have to achieve their ends, which are very human ends. I mean, we don't want to be alone. We want to connect with other people. We want to feel liked. We want to be part of the in-group. That's something that we're not going to eliminate from the lives of young people. The best we can do is order it well. And it becomes very, very difficult to help young people to learn how to order that well when all of that happens through personal digital devices.
Well, you talk about in the book here about you know, issues of temperance and controlling things. You talk about, for example, there's, you know, confusion about all sorts, acute confusion about moral matters today. You know, contrary gospels to the Lord of life in the Bible. You know, we can, you know, there's just all sorts of opinions about when we can end our lives or, you know, kill children in the womb or to be able to marry whomever we want for as long as we want or whatever. Does this social media really sort of befit or promote such an anarchic age? How can any sort of order reestablish itself?
Well, I mean, I want to make a distinction between two different ways that people can be led astray. And one, they can be led astray intentionally, and another, they can be led astray unintentionally. And I think we give a lot of our own attention to the ways in which people might be intentionally trying to lead us astray. So we notice if it looks like someone is trying to propagandize us or trying to push an agenda. If it looks like censorship is trying to prohibit certain ideas from being examined, or if there's an a dominant narrative that is trying to tell us what to think. We're very much attuned to those things, and we should be. But actually, you know, in this book, Chris and I are more worried about the unintentional ways in which the mind can be led astray. I mean, there are very basic operations of the intellect in judging what things are and reasoning about what follows from the natures of things. And it seems to me that more insidious than false assertions about the natures of things is the ability of the modern technological environment to distract us from the very act of making those judgments. I mean, I think a lot of people who are misled, say, about abortion, right? There are some loud voices who are misled about abortion, who know that it involves the taking of a human life, but they are trying to push an agenda and make sure that nobody learns that fact. But I think a lot of people who are misled about abortion, right, have not had the opportunity to stop and reflect what it is that they're making a judgment about. And so really what Chris and I want this book to do is help people to regain control over their own minds. It's called a mind at peace because the inner peace that we want is the inner peace of human beings as rational creatures, which means that we have to learn how to use our minds in the way that they were intended. And our minds were intended to both connect us to other people in friendship, in society, and to know and love the truth, ultimately to know and love the truth in God. And we can't know and love the truth in God if we don't already have daily habits of exercising our mind to grasp things for what they are. Say, for instance, that a human embryo is a human being and that murdering it would be a great tragedy. That kind of common sense ability to see things for what they are in the world, again, it can be intentionally driven out of us by false ideology. But we didn't really write about that. In fact, false ideology gains traction when the other means of leading us astray already has the upper hand. And the other means of leading us astray is simply distraction, simply not allowing the mind to form the right concepts, simply not allowing the mind to make an affirmative judgment, convincing the mind that it doesn't have the power to do those things, sowing seeds of skepticism, of doubt, or even simply distracting us to pay attention to something else altogether. And I think that is the key feature of our modern technological environment, that not that it forces us to do evil things, but that it distracts us from thinking of ourselves as moral agents who are responsible for doing good or evil and have to make that choice. It's very easy to go through life today and not even be aware of oneself as a moral agent, not even be aware of oneself as someone who has the responsibility for making sound judgments, or not even think of oneself as capable of defending sound judgments against objection. Those are intellectual skills that a healthy human being needs to cultivate and practice and exercise, and if we don't do those things, they atrophy, and then we are more susceptible to propaganda, to ideology, to control.
Yes, well, that brings up interesting issues. you talk about that the enjoyment of interior peace was once known as being the reward of virtuous living and an appropriately restrained sensory life, and also a heart often lifted to God. Does that mean then that, you know, God-fearing people, people have a relationship with God, they're going to deal with this modern technology, this social media, better than secularists? I mean, how will they approach these issues?
I think yes and no. I mean, there's sort of two facets to our book. We're drawing very much on classical wisdom, which assumes a kind of openness to a generic theism, let's say, but not necessarily a specific religious practice. And I think there's a lot of wisdom that can come from pagan, let's say, classical Greek and Roman reflection on the nature of the virtues. So Chris and I are happy to use language from Plato and Aristotle, for instance, or from Cicero, to describe what's sort of going on in the interior activity of the soul when one strengthens it and orders it for a peaceful life. But, I mean, obviously in the Christian tradition, there is both a sense that human beings cannot fully succeed at that on their own, that we need divine help, and that God has offered that help in a very concrete way through the person of his incarnate Son, Jesus Christ, who is a model of virtue and who enables us to achieve virtue through friendship with him in a way that isn't available in any other way. So, I mean, I think Christians have supernatural reason to hope. But a friend of mine commented on reading the book that a version of this book could have been written that that did not presume the Christian faith. There's no doubt reading this book that it's a book of Christian spirituality. Every chapter begins with a passage from scripture or from a spiritual master. It ends with a prayer. It ends with a series of questions for reflection, which are almost like a kind of examination of conscience for you to discern how the lessons might apply to your own interior life. So there's no doubt that the way we wrote it is as a Christian book, but there is much practical wisdom in the book that does not depend on any special revelation. It doesn't depend on any supernatural faith to apprehend, because so much of what we're dealing with is just the truth of the human person and how the human person can be authentically fulfilled. Jesus Christ reveals the fullness of human perfection to us in a way that no other means can manifest it. But the questions of what would fulfill human nature and some of the inclination about what would fulfill human nature is available even before the incarnation and before we learn about God's Trinitarian nature through Jesus. And that too is a sign of hope. The fact that in one way the challenges facing us in modernity are not entirely new challenges, and that there are resources available for us to make sense of them, and that we can apply those resources in our life, I think is an important part of the sense in which the book is a Catholic book. What I'm describing about the relationship between faith and reason is a very Catholic understanding. Faith can see farther than reason, but is always compatible with and leading out implications that reason might have been able to discern some inkling of, just as grace perfects nature, right? So God, by grace, offers us salvation, but the salvation he offers us is a salvation of ourselves as human beings, and we were somewhat aware of ourselves and our problems even before that salvation was available to us.
Well, you talk about in this context that temperance is a prerequisite to true freedom. I mean, that's a theme that, you know, we've discussed here. What would you say to, you know, sort of like woke people today? You know, they would think, well, you know, I'm truly free. I'm not bound by anything. And again, social media seems essence, you know, this sort of feeling of unbounded freedom, you know, no limits seems to argue against this. How would you proclaim that message today that people need temperance?
Well, I mean, there are other words for temperance, like moderation or self-control or some kind of self-restraint. I really don't think it's a controversial thing to say that a good human life involves some degree of that. I mean, you can disagree severely with someone about what the purpose of life is or how to order one's life or about good or evil, but even someone that you disagree with is going to find some domain of life in which they recognize that it's important to exercise restraint, to have the passions somehow disciplined. Maybe they want to indulge one set of passions, but in order to indulge that set of passions, they will have to discipline some other set of passions, right? I mean, those who might advocate what you and I would think of as licentious behavior, right, are also very, very quick to point out the dangers of indulging the passion of hate, right? So they're very, very hyper-attuned to anything that in their eyes looks like it would be an exercise of hate, whether it's in speech or in action. Now, you and I might agree, you might disagree in all sorts of ways about what they're counting as hate or about whether things that they think count as hate are actually manifestations of that or something else. But even in their own language, they can't avoid the fact that they think there are some passions that need to be reined in and maybe even social structures that need to be imposed on us so that we can better structure our lives to live together in an authentic community. I mean, in a perverse way, the very fact that modern culture in Western societies is often constituted by very, very pointed ideological disagreement is itself a sign of hope to me that people are still trying to understand what life is about and how it should be ordered and what we need to do in order to live together in community. Will the forms that our arguments take be fruitful? Will we come to better agreement and understanding? I'm not so hopeful usually, but the fact that people are still trying to formulate some vision of what a good and healthy human life should look like, even if that vision is very different from my own, the fact that they're still willing to do that is actually a very consoling human fact.
Well, you know, you talk about when we talk about temperance, and particularly with respect to social media, I guess, you know, other people would argue. I mean, on the other side, that, you know, social media. I guess you think of Twitter or Facebook. You know, it's really become sort of a modern news source, or you know, for all sorts of breaking news, or maybe people would. I don't know, follow the stock market with their smartphones or weather or you make all sorts of appointments. I mean, how necessary is such a smartphone and social media today? And, you know, I guess how do you balance this as a tool, as you've indicated before, without becoming addicted?
I mean, that's a great question, and I'm not sure that I've even answered it for myself. Part of the reason that I wanted to collaborate on this book is to make sense of my own use of a smartphone. I have a smartphone, and I'm also on Twitter. I'd love if your listeners wanted to follow me on Twitter. So that makes me, you know, arguably something of a hypocrite. At least if I'm not using Twitter in a perfectly virtuous way, which I think is hard to do. The fact is there's so many different things one can do with this technology now that nobody's doing all of them. Everybody is finding some particular way that it's useful to them. So, you know, some people are refreshing their phones and checking the stock market all the time. Some people are posting pictures on Instagram all the time. Some people are checking their favorite, political blogs to know what the latest outrage is in this controversy or that controversy. People, even to take just the example of Twitter, people use Twitter for different reasons. There are people who use Twitter to be funny and to post jokes. There are people who use Twitter to find news, as you described. There are people who use Twitter to engage in philosophical argument, which is what I try to do sometimes. The medium of Twitter is something that the individual user can curate, and you can filter things out and ignore certain things and focus on certain things. And it's everybody's Twitter experience is very, very different. I don't necessarily encourage people to be on Twitter if they don't want to be, but if people say it's all garbage or it's all a kind of mindless pollution, I say, well, it is if you don't filter things out very well. So if you follow thoughtful accounts, and if you ignore and block those who try to intrude upon your reading, you can actually have a very intellectual experience on Twitter. There's some very smart people on Twitter, and I've learned. I've gotten book recommendations. I've made connections that led to opportunities to write or meet people or go to conferences in real life. So I do think that social media can be used in a moderate, well-ordered way. But I think it takes a lot of work and intentionality, and one has to be thinking about one's own propensity to certain kinds of vices and what you need to be careful of, and one needs to think about what virtues one can best practice if one's using this. I'm very good at talking about the dangers of technology, but I'm not a Luddite. I don't think that we can go back to a world in which these things don't exist. And I think that's another important part of the message that Chris Bloom and I wanted to get across, that we can be honest about the challenges and difficulties of social media without being pessimistic or unrealistic, that we can actually find a constructive way forward together.
One thing you talk about is that people may be tempted to soothe psychological pain with a leap of digital distraction, but you know, this is cowardice and not courage, and cannot heal. And that if you have self-pity or stress or boredom or suffering, you need to look to the cross and upon the Lord. What sort of spiritual disciplines would you recommend for dealing with social media and its problems?
Well, I definitely think that people who spend a lot of time on social media should make sure they spend a significant amount of time praying about their use of social media. That's part of the purpose of the reflection questions that we have at the end of each chapter. For one, is to give people a kind of concrete way to engage in some self-examination. I think it's also important for people to talk to friends or people that they respect about social media use. It's good to have someone in your life that you trust can tell you if they think that you're overindulging in something, or that you've gone too far, or spend too much time in one area of life and not enough on another. I also think, if we're talking specifically about social media, all the social media platforms that I'm aware of do have, people on there who are themselves very overtly trying to cultivate virtues or live a Christian life, and it can be helpful to have those people as part of your network as a kind of reminder that and almost a kind of accountability that I want to hold myself to these standards. I want to live up to these ideals. But honestly, I mean, there's a circularity here, because part of what digital media makes it hard to do is to pray. And part of the purpose of our book is to help people to become stronger at the act of prayer. But that means that if one has gotten into a loop of being led astray and distracted by social media, one might find it hard to read the book, hard to concentrate, hard to engage in the kind of prayer that one needs. But I guess then at the end of the day, my advice would be simply to stop and pray. I mean, there's no substitute for that kind of intentional focus of attention and elevation of one's mind to dwell on God and to think about God's intention for your life we want to help people to be able to do that, but that's also a very important starting point. We want people to recognize that if they're going to survive the kind of onslaught of digital technology, that they're going to need to start in humility and asking for God's help. It is a serious challenge. It is a very, very serious challenge. And I do think people have spoken very frankly about not just sort of digital addiction, but in a sense kind of losing their souls, feeling that they sort of poured all of the energy of their interior life into superficial things instead of into the things that mattered. And that's a real danger.
Well, thinking of that, you talk in the book that true friends are rare and are usually come into people's lives as gifts of divine providence. How would you compare friendship on social media, with true friendship? I mean, you know, friendship in your daily lives. I mean, how do those concepts sort of contradict each other? You know, does social media undermine that, or how do they interact?
Yeah, I mean, on one level, they're nothing the same. True friendship involves cooperating with someone else in actual daily life. As embodied beings, it implies living together or in proximity. It implies seeing each other face to face and being able to cooperate on concrete activities where one is aware of how the one is helping the other. And obviously you don't exactly do that on social media. That said, there is a kind of analogy between the kind of relationship that can develop on social media. I mean, people on social media can have a common purpose. People on social media can get to know each other better rather than worse. People on social media can gain better understandings of each other and offer help to each other, or even correct each other and chastise each other in Christian charity. Obviously, there's not a hard and fast line between the relationships one makes on social media and in real life. So I mentioned, you know, I've met people on Twitter that I subsequently met in real life, and have been able to cultivate friendship over time, you know, offline, as it were, even though it might have begun online. And likewise, there are people that I was friends with, you know, offline in real life, whom I've had an opportunity to engage with further on social media, and that has been a kind of supplement. I think the danger is that that's easier for someone of my generation, of your generation, to see. As I said, you know, we grew up without this technology, and so we've learned how to integrate it into a life that developed without it. So our conception of friendship already existed before social media, and we find social media something that at best might be able to augment friendship. But increasingly, some young people at least, they actually have fewer and fewer chances to experience friendship in real life. I think the pandemic made this even worse for some students, and there's all sorts of talk about depression and anxiety among young people. They simply didn't have a chance to to hang out with other people. They're sharing common interests and doing things together and feeling like they were part of a community together. And so their primary understanding of getting to know someone and having common interests might be mediated through social media. And, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't have social media, but I'm saying that we should be aware that someone for whom friendship is first developed through the mediation of screens and buttons and not in real life, they might need help developing a stronger sense of friendship. I think it will be harder. It would be harder for someone who had never experienced friendship without social media, say, to get married, because marriage is something that doesn't take place online. It's you know, it's embodied, it's physical. It's you live together, you share space in a house. Likewise, I think it would be harder for somebody who only knows friendship through social media to pray. Prayer, in a sense, is a kind of exchange between friends. It's turning to God and knowing that He cares about you. And whether it's petitionary prayer or whether it's a prayer of thanksgiving or whether it's just simply a contemplative prayer of enjoying the presence of God, if you've never enjoyed the presence of a person, if you've never learned what it is to be honest with another person and to face them with your worries and your cares and your fears and to receive their correction or to offer correction to them, I think your experience of prayer as conversation with God would be very, very different.
I guess closing out here, one thing you talk about is the common good of a society, and that this is more than just sort of, you know, getting your fair share of resources, but creating a common good of, and pursuing a common good society is much harder in a subjectivist culture where, you know, everything's relativistic and up for debate. What should be the common good of society and how we come away from that in America, and how does that relate to social media?
Well, I mean, the common good is always relative to the community one is speaking of. So the common good of my classroom with my students is that the students learn together and that I help them learn. And things that contribute to that are welcome in the classroom, and I try to make sure that there are as few things that would impede that as possible. The common good of a company is, you know, to make a quality product and to sell it for a reasonable profit. And again, people, the company is successful to the extent that people are able to contribute their own part to that common good, and not everybody might be contributing the same way. The accountant contributes differently from the production line worker, who contributes differently from the CEO, who contributes differently from the truck driver. But if they all recognize themselves as part of a common project, then they have a common good that they're collaborating on, and it gives their life a purpose. But of course, these are all finite communities and finite common goods. Ultimately, our common good is life with God, right? As human beings, we are spiritual, intellectual creatures who were made to know and love God. And so our common good involves worship and communion with the Lord. You mentioned the national common good, and I think it's one of the biggest challenges of modernity is whether it's even possible to conceive of a national common good. Some of our biggest political arguments are really about how we should characterize what is the common purpose of Americans. And that's a very hard conversation to have. Once upon a time, you know, maybe we all took it for granted that we all agreed on what that is. You know, most people find it easier either to consider a more local common good of their own community or their own sphere of influence, or they might think about the ultimate common good, as I was saying, religion orients us towards life with God. But, you know, maybe it is an exacerbating factor of the challenge of digital media that it has heightened our attention to neuralgic national conversations that are alienating to most people.
All right, then. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your host, Andrew Herod, a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to discuss important issues today for conservatives and others. And we've been talking here with Mount St. Mary's University philosophy professor Joshua Hochschild about social media and keeping peace of mind on and off social media. He's the author of co-author of the 2017 book, A Mind at Peace, Reclaiming an Ordered Soul in the Age of Distraction by Sophia Institute Press. Well, Joshua Hochschild, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you so much, Andrew. This is a great conversation. Thanks.
Well, and for our listeners out there, tune in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, and also as well next Monday for a return of the Vito Esposito Show with Big Al at its regular time at 6 p.m. on Monday. Thank you very much. Talk to you shortly.